Did you miss us, Barry?
I did miss you.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So where have you guys been? Why haven't we been able to get together for 3GT for such a long time?
I'm just gonna blame Kyle, really.
Whoa, no. Hold, Austin, I was there with you 3 weeks ago when we were set to record. We've got to blame Barry on this one.
Well, actually, that's a good point. Yeah, he was like acting like a host or something. I don't know, but.
Yeah, we've had some out-of-town guests, and so some of our nights haven't worked out for us. And then this teaching period, I've had a hard time because I teach at night, and so our typical night to record, I haven't been available. So it's been hard for us to get together. Of course, Kyle's been gallivanting across the countryside too, going to weddings
Yeah,
and
that's
things
true.
like that.
That
That's
is
true.
true, yes.
Yep, I have done no gallivanting. In fact, most people have just been gallivanting to me, which is kind of nice.
And that was part of the reason too, is you were hosting one time and we weren't able to get
Yeah.
going.
That is a
No,
well-made point, Barry. A well-made point.
So I guess if we just quit
Yeah.
practicing hospitality and ministering to other people, we
Yikes.
could do more 3GT and.
Yeah. So now let me get this right. You said, and I can't remember, email or text, that you finished your dissertation. Is that right?
I did. I handed it in this week, so I'm a relieved man.
Yay!
Yeah. So
Congratulations.
the next step is to defend it.
Well, the committee will review it, and if there are any revisions necessary, then they'll send those to me and we'll interact that way. But
All right. And
Lord
what did
willing,
you do it on?
it was on the marks of the church.
Oh, okay. You did do. Okay.
The
So whatever happened to that book? You wrote a book a while back and you put that on hold. Is that going to see the light of day here?
Well, that's part of this. I've been working on this project for a long time, and I decided that I needed to do more research, and I really, really am glad that I did that because I felt like it made it a better, just better, a little deeper and hopefully more helpful if I ever get this thing out in print sometime.
You know, Barry, what you should have done when you handed your dissertation in is you should have declared to the review committee that this is the permanent text of your dissertation and it will never be edited again.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen.
I've heard that's not the way to go.
Yeah. So how long did the actual permanent text of the ESV last?
I think 3 hours.
I think in the public's eye, probably about 3 weeks, but I think it was last time we met on 3GT, we commented on Crossway's decision to make the ESV the permanent text, and to their credit, they recanted that, and that had to hurt. So,
Yeah.
yeah, I'd like to think that we were played a, you know, an integral part of that.
Oh, I'm real sure we did.
Yeah, that's very likely.
Extremely. Oh, man.
Probably one of our five listeners contacted them
Yeah. Permanent text, it's going to be huge.
and Yeah, and we've had an election since last time as well.
A
what?
Yep.
A
We're
what?
kind
Tell
of we're kind of
yeah.
we're kind of
Tell me about
rewinding here.
this. To tell me about this election.
The news hasn't gotten out to Winchester yet.
No. No, we're still waiting for the pony to come through.
Yep. And I could do a little bit of gloating. I won't, but I could.
In what sense?
Well, remember, I think it was January that we had to put all our money down on people. And sadly, you picked Ted Cruz, Barry, and he was quickly put away with. I can't remember what you said, Kyle. You said Hillary would win, right?
I think I did, yes.
Well, and in all fairness, about a week out, I really, really. I mean, if somebody said you could have $1 million if you guessed this right, I would have said, "Oh, Hillary in a heartbeat." Yeah, and I would have lost $1 million. So my prophetic skills wavered in the face of Comey.
Yeah, the FBI has a way of doing that.
That brought it back, but yeah, I was until that happened. I was like, oh, this is just. I mean, those debates were just fiascos.
Yeah. Well, someone else who's had a bad year besides Hillary, I would say, is Wayne Grudem. Because not only has he struggled with his Trinitarian doctrines, but then he first endorsed Trump, and then I think he withdrew his endorsement, and who knows yep. what he's doing today.
Well, he went back. He went back.
Which makes me wonder, you know, how they do all these voter analysis and everything. I wonder what the correlation is between people who really believe in the Trinity and the proper view of the relationship between the Father and Son and those who didn't vote for Trump.
Yeah. I'm going to say, man, maybe two.
No, I think it would be really high if you had true Trinitarian doctrine. You probably wouldn't be a Trump supporter.
Hey Barry, there's your next dissertation. Okay.
Yeah right. No, that's his death knell. Is what that is. Yeah.
But it has been a tough year for Wayne Grudem, and apparently the rumor mill is that yesterday when he presented at the Evangelical Theological Society, it didn't improve for him.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Did he try to defend his position?
Yeah, he did. He and Bruce Ware came out and said, we support eternal generation now, but there's still some question about whether or not they've redefined that. And then he and Bruce Ware tried to defend their position at ETS, and the word that I got, none of that's recorded, but the word I got is Millard Erickson just let them have it. So,
wow.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. I'd be curious. I believe it when I hear it kind of thing. I'm going to be the skeptic here. I'm going to be the skeptic. Because I listened to actually both of them do a debate against two other gentlemen whose names escape me. And I thought they handled themselves actually very well. So I don't see
anybody. Did you vote for Trump? I mean, that really will explain everything.
Nope.
So,
nope.
Oh, bummer.
There goes Barry's theory.
Yeah.
Didn't do it. I said I'm going to vote for Trump if he can control himself for 90 minutes three times. Couldn't do it. He lasts about 20 minutes, and then he just go bonkers. So I was like, can't do it.
That was the litmus test you used as to whether or not you'd vote for him?
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, there was other factors that came into play, obviously, as more things came out. But back before the debates ever happened, that's what I was saying to myself.
So, Austin, is Trump really like your boss since you're a postman?
Oh.
I mean...
Ultimately, no?
I mean, I know the Postmaster General is your true boss, but who appoints him?
Hmm. You know, I don't even know.
Well, that's the Postmaster General is appointed by the president.
Yeah. Is it really? Is it still?
Have you ever seen the movie Air Force One where Harrison Ford appoints a new Postmaster General?
Awesome. Let me ask Google here. Does the president appoint the Postmaster General?
I think the movie reference has to be a vindication.
It's Harrison Ford.
Well, that's true. Since it's Harrison Ford. I don't know. We'll have to look into this.
I think he's your boss now, Austin. And I was wondering, is serving in the post office, since it's a government position, is it sort of like the army where there's this sense of duty?
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
So yeah. Like in the army, if there's a need somewhere, you know, a good soldier would go to the front lines or wherever he's needed. I just read an article that says that Massachusetts is in need of 500 postal carriers. So I was wondering if, you know, you might be considering moving to Massachusetts.
Well, let me put it this way. Actually, my wife just today put on Facebook a picture of our news forecast, which said, I think, cold blast. You know how they do that? They'll put those this big kind of freezing image, you know, cold letters, you know, over the United States. It's like cold blast coming to Florida. And it's going to get down to 40, but it's still like a high of 65 or 70. And they're talking about getting out your puffy winter coats and stuff. So that's kind of where I like cold blasts to start and stop. So
Massachusetts, it is not.
Not going to happen. No.
Well,
sense of duty only goes so far, I take it.
Oh, absolutely.
Not only apparently his sense of his own understanding and place in the world. So according to Wikipedia, Until 1971, the post office was a member of the presidential cabinet. But in 1971, they became an independent agency of the executive branch.
Ooh. Ah, okay.
So the president no longer appoints. So Austin, you have nothing to do with the new executive branch.
I kind of suspected that. So yeah, I feel good about this, Barry. No, I feel good. So, Trump can, you know, Trump can tell me to go, and I can go. I'm sorry, sir. I'm staying right here.
He can't say you're fired.
Yeah. So I mean, so let's not go too long on this, but encapsulate your thoughts for me. Where you're at on the, I mean, clearly this has captivated America's attention, and everybody's, to a certain degree, sick of it. But I want to know your guys' honest thoughts in 30 seconds each. Where are you at?
Well, the Lord's on his throne, and he delights to show us our folly, and we'll wait and see. I do have hopes that he can work through any ruler, and so I have hopes that he'll work through Trump to bring some changes that are needed. He's chosen a good vice president, and hope that he'll choose some other key people that will help guide him in wisdom. And, you know, maybe the Lord will use them to help on the Supreme Court or other places like that. But my confidence is not in Trump, just in the way the Lord can use any ruler.
Sure. Okay, that was a pretty safe answer, but a good one. How about you, Kyle?
Well, forget the safe answer. I remain confidently pessimistic about this nation.
That's just your eschatology coming up.
Yeah, it really is. It's terrible, isn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, you know what? I kind of just say give him a shot, right? I mean, he's there. Let's see what he can do. Am I optimistic? No, I mean, not really. I think the church in their support of him really have set themselves up for disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have been a wiser course of action to talk like how Barry did in his answer. And a lot of people didn't. So I think they're set up to get some egg on their face.
Yeah. So. Yep, I think they're going to be a lot more Wayne Grudems before it's over.
I want to talk common grace, and...
You want me to start it? You want me to start it?
Yeah, just set it up here. We're going right now. Just... Why do you want to talk about common grace?
Well, there's been some discussion in the background I won't necessarily get into on 3GT, but just some discussion about common grace. And I think it's a term that we often throw around in the church, but maybe a lot of people don't understand what it is. And so I thought it'd be interesting to just discuss it a little bit, what it means, why is it important, what might be its applications to us. So let me ask you guys, when you hear that term, I mean, first of all, I think to most people, it almost sounds like a misnomer, because when we talk about grace, we often want to put the word amazing in front of it. And rightly so, when we're speaking of our salvation, we think of amazing grace. But common grace really isn't necessarily, it isn't talking about the grace that God exhibits in saving people. So what is it? Does it actually mean? What is that term saying, communicating?
Yeah, and before we do that, let me maybe just back up just a hair. So explain to me, either one of you, why even a hesitancy in the first place? I mean, is this a, are there just some Calvinists out here, some Reformed folks who aren't a big fans of the doctrine? And if so, why? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, I'm married to a woman whose maiden name is Hooksema. And there was
Barry, you just take this one.
And there was a denomination formed called the Protestant Reformed Church. One of their defining distinctives is that there is no such thing as common grace. And so it has been a issue of discussion in church history, and people either deny it or don't like the term. So,
well, and what's the impulse then? I mean, why an impulse to be like, yeah, God doesn't have, as it were, common grace? I mean, where's the impulse there?
Well, part of it, for and Barry's alluded to this, is definition. You know, usually when we think of grace and the way that we have typically defined grace is perhaps not always the best definition for what we mean by grace. Unmerited favor, or if you want to go, demerited favor, you know. And I think part of the tension when you understand that, especially as you come at this question from a reform perspective, where, you know, we understand that there are those who are elect, who have been the objects of God's everlasting love, and there are those who are reprobate, who are in a very real sense not loved by God. And so, is he showing grace? Is he showing unmerited favor to those who are objects of his wrath? And so I think part of it is just, as Barry said, it's nomenclature. It's definitions. Is common grace really the best vocabulary word to express the idea of God's goodness towards all of creation, or God's benevolent providence toward creation? So I think some of it's definitions, but...
Well, okay. I mean, surely a Hoaxum a Crowd and those of that ilk would say the fact that someone who's non-elect isn't destroyed immediately on the planet is in, what would be the word they would use? Because they agree with that, so they don't say common grace. So what would they say? What's the term there? Like his patience, or his, you know, what would they say?
Well, I think, you know, again, we want to probably, just for the sake of our listeners, to make sure everybody understands what we mean by common grace, just to be a little more particular about it. This is the goodness of God that all mankind experiences living here on his earth. So a common text to go to for this is at the end of Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus talks about how God makes the sun shine or the rain fall on both the righteous and the wicked alike. And then he encourages us in the same manner then to, for instance, love our enemies. So when we're talking about common grace, we're talking about what I would call the goodness of God to all of his creatures. It falls really, it does fall under the doctrine of providence, that he oversees all things, he governs over all affairs of mankind, and so he allows even the wicked to enjoy his good gifts here on the earth. So they do appreciate the sunshine, they do benefit from the rain, they have food and drink and health and family and all the types of things that God
they're
has
not being destroyed immediately, right?
Right.
I mean,
so,
and they're getting things that they don't deserve.
That's right. So that's typically what's meant by the term.
So what would they call those things if not common grace? I mean, I have no idea what you would, I mean, okay, fine, you don't like the term grace, or you don't like the term common, or both of them together, but so I mean, what do you call it? Just common goodness, or patience, or I guess I'm kind of at a loss. It feels like theologians wrangling over nomenclature here.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, well, it goes back a little bit to what Kyle was saying, in that I think what they would refer to it as is that these are, you know, good gifts of God, but there's no grace in it, because every time, let's say, a wicked person enjoys a day of sunshine or enjoys his marital relationship or his children, whatever it is that he's enjoying, but he doesn't give God the glory in that, that he's not receiving grace, because he's just going to be storing up further wrath for himself on the day of judgment. And so to call something that he's enjoying at that moment grace, when ultimately it's going to bring further judgment upon his head on the day of retribution, to those who deny the doctrine. They feel like that's just a miscommunication of truth. That would be, I think, how they would.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, it just kind of gets my heckles up because, you know, we've talked about this stuff before, but I mean, to me, it's just reductionistic. It's this, oh, election is the lens, the singular lens that everything else is supposed to be subsumed under without nuance, right? You if God only loves the elect in a special sense, well, there just can't really be anything for anybody else, and hence, you know, the universal offer, the gospel, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all that starts to get shoved under the rug of reprobation. You just go, yeah, I just think there's a failure in systematics here. And I think in just reading your Bible fairly, right? I mean, it says what it says.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to defend those who would deny common grace, especially the Protestant Reformed churches, but I do think part of the concern, you know, at least the way they frame it, the way that they would understand it, it's not merely an argument over words. You know, I think one of the fears is that it would give an excuse to introduce worldliness into the church. That if the world has all these good things that God is doing, then why can the church not latch on? And I think it's an overreaction. I'm not going to defend it. But I think from their perspective, they look at that and say, well, you're just opening the door for worldliness to prevail in the church by speaking in terms of common grace.
So. Yeah, and I just would just go right back to, yeah, and you're just running right through the door of reductionism.
So I think all of us agree there, maybe not the best terminology, but all of us agree in a concept of common grace. So why is that important? Barry started alluding to some of that, but what else would you guys say is very practical as we think about common grace?
Well, I'll go back to what I alluded to first, is that the Lord commands us to pray for our enemies instead of acting out in vengeance against them. And I think it reflects, you know, God is patient. He's waiting for men everywhere to repent. And I think that it teaches us that if God is patient and allowing the wicked life here on the earth, then we should be following him and doing so also. So that would be one area that I think is important. And that would impact, you know, how we do evangelism, how the church relates to the world. I think there's lots of applications because of that.
Yeah. I would point to Romans 2:4, where it says, and Paul's building his case against sinful humanity here, and he says, Or do you show contempt for the riches of his kindness, tolerance, and patience, not realizing that God's kindness leads you towards repentance? If you eviscerate the reality of God's love, real love, towards fallen man, elect and non-elect, then how in the world can they spurn the riches of his kindness, tolerance, and patience, not realizing that God's kindness leads you towards repentance? To me, all this is bound up with really a failure to understand the dimensions of God's love. I think it's really that simple. They have a more hyper-Calvinistic view that I think is sadly very unbiblical.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, it's how you would interact with. You don't have to go around and look for ease on people's heads to talk about the love of God. Now, I know that they, in practice, probably wouldn't do that, but, I mean, it's just where I am. I mean, if you can tell that I'm a, like I said, it gets my heckles up on this one. What about you, Kyle? Is there a...
Well, you know, I think one of the writings I've appreciated the most on this topic is Herman Bavinck wrote an essay on common grace. And in the essay, basically just a bit of historical background. So Bavinck is arguing that common grace was very present in Calvin's thought. And then after Calvin, it really diminished and disappeared from the theological world. And really through a lot of the efforts of Herman Bavinck and Abraham Kuyper in the 20th century, early 20th century, late 19th century, the Reformed came to deal with common grace again. And I love the way Herman Bavinck really portrays the nature of common grace. And he talks about how it is by God's common grace that he powerfully opposes the destructive might of sin. And then he goes on and he says it more eloquently than I can. So I'm just going to read a couple sentences. But he says that it's by common grace that he fills the hearts of men with nourishment and joy and does not leave himself without a witness among them. He pours out upon them numberless gifts and benefits, families, races, and peoples. He binds together with natural love and affection. He allows societies and states to spring up that the citizens might live in peace and security. Wealth and well-being he grants them, that the arts and sciences can prosper. And by his revelation in nature and history, he ties their hearts and consciences to the invisible, suprasensible world and awakens in them a sense of worship and virtue.
Yeah, wonderfully.
And then almost immediately after he says that, and I think this is what's wonderful, is he says, yet common grace is not enough, because it can compel, but it can't change. It can restrain, but it does not conquer. Unrighteousness breaks through its fences again and again. Saving grace is needed. But I love how Bavinck just draws in, really, you think of all the happiness, all the joy in a post-fall world. And so much of that is attributable to God's common grace. And without that, you know, without that powerful opposition to the destructive might of sin, the world in which we live would be a very different place, obviously. So
that would be a good quote to have in our notes for this. Just such a rich definition of it.
Yeah, so I still just kind of, the terminology, I can't see a real difference between saying God's common goodness or his patience or his grace. I don't know how you would sharply distinguish those words in my mind.
Well, how would you define grace, Austin?
Well, I mean, the classic, the street level one is unmerited favor, right? I mean, the fact that if someone deserves to die and they aren't dead, that's unmerited favor, right? They're getting something they don't deserve. And if you add to that actual goods, like we've been saying, a spouse that loves them and, you know, wonderful hobbies and all the rest, I can just as easily go, yeah, that's God being patient, that's God's being good, that's God's grace. I for the life of me, I just don't know why we would need to wrangle so heavily over trying to distinguish those that much. I mean, feel free to disagree, but it just seems like straining after a gnat.
I think, you know, many terms that we use in theology can have, they don't communicate all that great. I mean, for instance, you know, a lot of theologians have struggled just using, even they believe in it, but struggle using the term limited atonement, just because there's such a richness and fullness an infinite magnitude to it, to call it limited in any way just doesn't really do that doctrine justice. And I think with common grace, it seems to be the term focuses more on the recipient rather than the giver of it. And so I think that's probably some of the struggle, even in the Protestant Reform circles. I think a way to focus it back on God, you know, to talk about God's patience or God's beneficence to all mankind, I think is in some ways a better way to go, because just to put the word common in front of anything that God does is, you know, again, it's not the best term, even though it's still communicating something in the sense that we all have this in common. What we have in common with the unrighteous is that we're both living in a world that God has created at this time, and he's and we're enjoying the benefits of living here.
Well, and I was using the word reductionism. I think another word you could use is just it's flattening the, like, if you imagine a scenario where Christ, let's say, heals someone who ends up not believing. if you flatten the picture, you're just always going to see it in terms of the end game. In other words, he only reason he did this is so that he could make their condemnation even more grand, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. Like, wow, look at the extent of their unbelief. But that's just flattening it. The fact of the matter is Christ's heart was such is that he had compassion on the crowds, and that he'd be like, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, why won't you turn?
Right.
You know, and so there was a real aspect there, a real appeal, a real show of love that, yes, in the grand scheme of things, when they continue in their unbelief, will, you know, accrue to them greater judgment. I just go, yeah, it's, but we dare not flatten it either way. I mean, you know, you can certainly go in liberal circles and hear them talk about the love of God to such a degree that they flatten it to the exclusion of holiness and justice. And you go, well, you know, along these lines, I was just listening to N.T. Wright talk about his new book on the cross, and he was interacting with Thomas Schreiner on the podcast Unbelievable. And I was just struck again at, you know, talking about this other side. Like, he just won't hardly talk about God's wrath against sin, even when he's talking about the atonement. It's like, why is that? Well, I just think there is such a, you know, we talk about Grudem, we talk about all these different things. There's such a tendency when you have a doctrine that requires you to say two things very carefully and to not minimize the other and have balance. But it's so easy to topple one way or the other. And so I just think that's what's going on here with common grace.
Right. I do think if you deny common grace or don't hold to it, that it's going to give you a very stingy outlook on mankind. And I think you begin to me, it would just foster a, again, I'm not, just because someone has this doesn't necessarily mean that they're proud, but I think it would foster a pride, a sense of condescension as you look at other people. You wouldn't have the type of patience that God wants us to possess. It's one of the qualities of the Spirit, is to be patient with someone. And I think, and especially unbelievers, and I think that we really need this doctrine if we're going to truly make sense of God's word, God's world. And I do think, as you're saying, Austin, that to the tendency often in theology is to overemphasize something that can be true to the extent that we begin to minimize something else that needs to be maintained, and we start getting into trouble. We're not seeing God, we're not seeing his world accurately when we do that.
I know that if someone were to flatten my motivations, which is often what happens when you do something that's a complex action where you have all kinds of different goals and aspirations and motivations in your mind, you know, when you're approaching some kind of difficult situation, it's really, really frustrating when somebody says to you, or when somebody singles out just one motivation and sees all of it in light of that. And I just think, God's, I have no idea how honestly to even think of God's emotional life, but, you know, he's infinitely complex, and he's all of these things. And so it makes me uncomfortable to start thinking only through one lens with him. I have no idea how to put it all together. I mean, I'll be the first to say that there's great mystery in all this, but, you know, we got an eternity of time to figure it out. So, you know, I just say, let's be patient. We got some time. You've been pretty quiet, Kyle.
I've just been listening.
What do you think?
No, I agree. Yeah, I agree, and I think that's the fundamental problem with those who would deny common grace. So,
do you have an I Love Hoax in the t-shirt in your closet?
No.
I do, but it's just a different one.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So you want to go to your love of demons?
Love of demons.
Yeah. Well, you wrote a book on it.
Well, I'd like to think that I wrote a book that is more about the defeat of the demons.
Oh, okay, okay.
Than the love of them. But yeah, along those lines, did both of you read that article?
Yes.
Okay. Oh. So, you know what? It's been a while since I've read it, so let me just fumble through this by way of introduction. You guys just quickly fill in the gaps. I can't remember the man's name, but he is a professor of psychiatry in New York. Is that right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what was his name? Does somebody have that handy? Or if not, that's fine.
I'll have it in 1 second.
Okay.
It was a Washington Post article that you're referring to.
Yeah.
The Washington Post. His name is Richard Gallagher.
Richard Gallagher. Okay. Now this guy, and now it's been a little while since this has been out. This individual is a very reputable psychiatrist. I mean, there's no questioning his credentials. And so he writes this article in the Washington Post, basically, I wouldn't say defending so much as just asserting that he believes, seen cases, real cases, of demon possession, and that he's been even a part of what would be called exorcisms. Now, we won't, no need to, I guess, explain anything beyond that, but just by way of initial impressions, I'm genuinely curious, what did you guys think of this article? And I'll link to it so that others can read it, because it is fascinating. But what do you think?
Well, it's good to see someone admitting that there's more than just some naturalistic explanation for the things that he's evidenced, which is it's interesting, just our whole culture. You think about the entertainment industry. You know, again, we live in a land where most people fall under secular humanism, and yet so many of them still have this fascination with the spiritual world and, you know, evil and demons and all these vampire shows, so all those things in the culture. So it's good to see a scientist admitting that there are things that go beyond a naturalistic explanation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll come back with the question to both of you, but what are your thoughts, Kyle? Can I just ask a bold question? Do you think he's full of baloney?
No, I think he has a very good potential to be misinterpreting things. I think he's witnessing certain phenomena, in some cases, that he can't find another explanation for. And I think that's where, you know, part of me really liked the article for that aspect, where he said, look, I can't find a psychiatric explanation for what I'm witnessing. What I found interesting is that his reasoning then seemed to be, because I can't find another explanation, it therefore must be demon possession. I there's a part of me that kind of wishes he had said, well, I can't rule out demon possession. I'm not going to say definitively this is a possession by a demonic spirit, but his reasoning was a little lacking there with me. I agree with Barry. Here's a Yale trained psychiatrist who by no stretch of the imagination is a dummy in his field, and he's not chalking everything up to naturalism and materialism. At the same time, I remain very skeptical. And if we want to get into that, I assume we will.
Well,
I
guess I'm curious. So, okay. If he's right, let's just say, because he listed, if I remember right, at least three. He may have mentioned more, but I remember three things that he mentioned that were evidences to him that this was a case of demon possession. And one was these people would speak in ancient tongues, which you go, okay. The other one was that these people would have insights into things in his life, particularly sins, that they could not have known. And another one was levitation. Now, I think we would all agree that if we saw all three of those things, particularly levitation, like, let me just pause here. Like, why would demons make somebody levitate? Okay, whatever. Let me go back. If we saw all three of those things, I think we would, and it was, had this darkness about it, I think we would be highly tempted to say, wow, this is demonic possession. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would be highly tempted, but the point, I guess, that in my completely removed situation, we must bring the scriptures to yield on our experience, not our experience to yield on the scriptures.
Oh, I agree. But Kyle, my goodness, what about the gospels then?
Well, part of the symptoms that he pointed out for demon possession, in my mind, unless you guys want to correct me, have no biblical support. You know, we do read right. language that demon possession led, I forget which one it was, to have some to have strength. He was able to do more than what ordinary men were able to do. Right. But there's no biblical support for the idea that in a demon possession, people are speaking in the only unknown right. tongues that people utter in scripture is the blessing of Pentecost. So I have difficulty with that. We get no sense from the scriptures that demons have some kind of pseudo omniscience, that they know things that people ought not to know. We have absolutely no biblical support that demons could cause a physical body to levitate. So I
Kyle,
look at some of those.
Hey, Kyle.
Yeah. Go ahead, Barry.
I mean, the levitation aside, some of the demons, when they saw Jesus, they cried out about his identity in ways that showed that they, had a knowledge of who he was as the Son of God that wasn't apparent to lots of other people. I mean, that would be just one place where you could say, well, they do exhibit some knowledge of the spiritual world that was not.
Oh, I'm not saying they didn't have a knowledge of the spiritual world. I'm just saying these unknown things that are unknown to all people, right? Jesus' identity was not in one sense unknown. He was very open with who he was. His miracles attested to it. He was attested to be the Son of God in public. Okay, I'll grant you that point if you want.
I'm just saying that they had seen him as the Son of God in heaven as fallen angels, and I think that's the knowledge by which they're crying out at that moment in time, not the common knowledge that, oh, this is the guy who, people are saying is the Son of God. I think they're, they know who he is.
Well, and to your point, Kyle, I really wrestle with this whole idea. There's a part of me that wants to go, man, I'm really skeptical of some of these things happening, particularly the particulars, right? Like levitation. You go, what? Okay, that just seems like a Hollywood thing. I mean, what would be the point of that? But then when I actually do read through the Gospels, it's like, man, like it clearly caused. Demons would cause physical problems, mental problems. It would cause people to, like, throw themselves in the fire. You could have them going into swine and jumping off cliffs. And apparently they probably, when they would cry out, like, you are the Son of God, it probably wasn't the person's normal voice in some sense.
I'm just, where would you get the sense that it's not the person's normal voice? Is that a Hollywood imposed?
No, I mean, it would be their vocal cords, right? But it would be, I mean, by very, the cadence and everything, right? I mean, it would be, and in one sense, a different being influencing another being to say a certain thing, right? So my guess, let me put it crassly. If I were suddenly demon-possessed right now, and started talking, you probably would go, man, that didn't sound like Austin. And that's all I mean. I don't mean like this weird, like spooky voice.
I'm just, I don't know. Okay, go on. I don't know where biblically you're going to support that at all.
Well, I can't.
Okay.
I mean, right. I mean, there's a lot of things we can't. I can't say that Noah got a splinter either, but he very likely did. Back to my main point, though, I grant to you that. I am very skeptical of it. But if all this stuff happens, and it does happen in the New Testament a lot, to the degree that it makes this Western Christian in the modern age uncomfortable.
Would you mind just editing that for a moment? Would you say not in the New Testament, in the Gospels?
Oh no, I would say in the New Testament. I mean, just read Acts.
Outside of a couple particular instances, Acts is not full of demon possessions by any means.
Well, no, not full of it. But
I mean, I can think of how many demon possessions were there in Acts.
Well, there's a slave girl.
And there's the sons of whatever his name is. Skeva. Acts.
Well, and just the overarching perspective, like, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. I mean, there definitely is a lot of emphasis on.
Well, so where would you draw the difference between demon possession and demonic activity?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, obviously Satan wreaked all kinds of havoc on Job's family using marauders and natural events. So, you know, and Satan entered Judas and played an integral part in his betrayal. I don't know. I mean, it's all very mysterious to me. I'm just agreeing with you that yes, as a Western Christian, I just go, man, for some reason I'm just very skeptical of that. But there is a lot, really, honestly, in the totality of the New Testament there that gives a person pause and makes me go, why would I be fundamentally opposed to this idea? I shouldn't be, right? Or should I be?
No, you know, I actually, and Barry can weigh in, he has been quiet here, but I actually, within Reformed Christianity, I think this is one of the issues we can agree to disagree on. So I'm not going to come down dogmatically. I think this is an issue where I think Reformed people generally have a majority opinion on this. I would think the majority would say demon possessions no longer happen.
Okay. What would happen then?
Oh, I think demon oppression. I think a demonic struggle. You know, Ephesians 6, when you look at the armor of God, you know, each piece of armor, I think, corresponds with what we should be looking for as normative in demonic activity, right? Why are we told to put on the belt of truth? Because Satan's greatest weapon is falsehood. So wherever falsehood is, there we see, you know, demonic activity. There we see the prince of the power of air exerting his influence. So,
sure.
So that, but I might have my finger on the wrong pulse.
Kyle, why do you say, and just so that our listeners understand, why do you say that, you know, most Reformed folk don't believe in demon possession anymore?
Part of it, from my understanding, and again, I can be corrected on this, but what I've seen most often talked about in Reformed circles and among Reformed theologians is just the idea that during the earthly ministry, right, demon possession was by no means normative or an everyday occurrence in the Old Testament. Saul was overcome by an evil spirit, whether that was a demonic possession or not. But barring that, the idea of possession really broke in at the Gospels. And somewhat alluding to what I said earlier, I think the book
on the false prophets, right, with the lying spirits into the there's a few other places, but yeah, to your point, I'm sorry to jump in like that.
I forgive you. I'm just kidding. So the way that I've seen, to get to Barry's point, question, the way that I've seen most Reformed people respond to this is that demon possession and those that we see primarily in the Gospels, which I think are the vast majority of instances, really reflect a particular climax of redemptive history. And that with the coming of the Son of God in the flesh, you see all of hell itself stirring itself up against Christ. But as Christ comes and begins to preach the kingdom, you know, the earliest chapters of the Gospel of Mark, I think Mark is one of the Gospels that brings out demonic activity the plainest. You begin to see that the strong man has been bound, and something pivotal really did happen at the cross. He really did disarm principalities and authorities. Does that mean that they don't exert influence, that we don't still contend against these things? No. But I think Reformed theologians that I have read have looked and said, you know, something happened at the cross. Here was the climax of redemptive history. But now on this side of the cross, we don't see that activity as much. We see the work of Satan in other ways. So,
yeah. And
is that fair? Barry, do you think most Reformed people would say, or what do you think on that?
Yeah, I do believe that there is a definitive breaking of Satan's power that occurred at the cross that's getting worked out through time and history. I'm a little hesitant to say, I agree with you about the article in the sense that probably where he's seeing demonic activity, he's calling it necessarily possession, which again, we would have to define. What do we mean when we say, what's the difference between demonic possession versus demonic oppression? And I think, you know, as we look at, for instance, the Gerasene demoniac, it's when the evil one has, you know, taken residence in a soul, or more than one demon has taken residence in a soul and is controlling all the thoughts and behaviors of a person. I think that's what we mean by that. And we would say that the outburst of that was occurring in conflict with Jesus' arrival, the Lord has broken a lot of that power, and as the gospel's going out, it's driving the demons, you know, away, in the sense of the power to do these kinds of things isn't as great as it once was. I you know, whether that means that no one, you know, this side of the cross could be possessed by a demon, I'm not quite ready to say that. But I would think that would be few and far between where it's actually an oppression. Now, on the other hand, I do think that there is demonic activity that often, because of our Western worldview and the blindness that we have because of our technology and all of that, I think sometimes we're really blind to the activity of Satan in the Western world and are not recognizing it when we should be.
Yeah, and you know what? I have to think about it more. But I'll tell you what my instincts are, Kyle.
You wrote the book. Do you really have to think about it more?
Well, I didn't.
Shameless plug. Austin wrote a book called "The Fall of Satan." Is that correct?
Or Satan's Awful Idea.
And Satan's Awful Idea. It is available on Amazon.com.
Yeah, and in all fairness, I did not. One of my even minor concerns did not include any of these kinds of questions. I had far bigger things in mind than to try to parse the difference between oppression and possession. And I guess that's what I was going to say, is my instincts really do tell me that trying to do some kind of systematic study on a biblical difference between possession and oppression is going to be unfruitful. That's my suspicion. Is that it's going to be assumption laden, and there's going to be all kinds of semantic games going on, unless you could have somehow established that as the cross made that theologically impossible, that there is a difference between oppression and possession, and that B, the cross eliminated the possibility of possession. I find those two very... I can't imagine how you would establish those. I mean, maybe somebody has, but I'm not aware of it.
And maybe we don't need to get too weighed down by that.
Yeah, true. I guess so. Yeah, so I guess the question would be with this guy in this article. I think he did use the term possession, if I remember right. So if we just take that...
That's the title of his article.
Okay.
And he says, you know, he does make a pretty big claim here. He says that he believes that he has seen more demon possessions than anyone else in the whole world.
Wow. So, yeah. I mean, that's a bold claim.
That's a claim. But
yeah.
Again, the general sense of the article, I think, is more what we're thinking about here.
Yeah. So to try to find some kind of conclusion on this, or at least some concluding thoughts.
Oh, I have one more question before you get to concluding thoughts.
Oh, yeah, go for it. Yeah.
If I can ask it, this is probably going to be a little offensive, so feel free to say we're not going to go there. Do either of you, or did either of you in reading the article, find it interesting that here is another case of so-called demon possession and exorcisms existing within the sphere of Roman Catholicism?
Yeah.
I guess that's where I wanted a little more information. So, you know, for instance, when he's seen exorcisms, you know, do they balk at holy water being thrown on them? Because I don't think that's biblical. And I guess I wanted some more of those details spelled out, because I find concerns with Roman liturgy when it comes to exorcisms. So.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And there's, I think there's other layers to this as well. Like, clearly there were Jewish exorcists in the time of the New Testament. I mean, we even see examples where some are trying to do what Paul could do, and then, you know, what's the demon do? It, like, throws them out naked. I have no idea what to make of these things. Like, wait a minute, what were these exorcists doing? And there's that passage in the Gospels where it's like, remember, they're like, hey, these people over here, this other crowd of people are throwing out demons, and Christ's like, look, if they're not against us, you know, they're with us. So I am just perplexed. Okay, let me just back up for a second. I'm not saying, therefore, that I'm drawing a parallel between those instances and Roman Catholics. I have no idea what to think of it.
Okay.
I have no idea what the... I mean, my impulse would be like, how could these guys have any authority to do this? You know what I mean? If you don't have the gospel right, it doesn't seem like you'd be able to handle demons aright. But, yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm just genuinely... There's a part of me... Oh, okay, I got an interesting question for you. If you could sit in and watch one of these, would you do it?
Watch a Roman Catholic priest one of do these, an exorcism?
Let's say this guy were to say to you, you know what, here's an instance of someone that I have seen levitate, and we're going to be doing another confrontation, and you're certainly welcome to come along. Would you do it?
If it was a Roman Catholic exorcism, I would not do it.
You wouldn't do it? Okay. No. What about you, Barry?
No, I wouldn't. It would just, to me, be legitimizing a wrong approach to trying to help somebody, so I wouldn't do it.
Would you watch a video of it?
Of course.
Well, okay. I just recently was listening to a podcast where they, it's usually about crimes, and this was about a crime, but it did have a case of demon possession, and they had an audio recording of this poor lady, and it did sound like another voice. I mean, it was incredible when you heard her anguish of soul and her talking, and then the way that she would go into a different voice. You know, again, is this just it didn't have any sense, just as you heard her history of, you know, her just acting this way. It seemed like she was being tormented. So I've listened to things. I don't really like it. It was creepy, but I did listen to this just because I was listening to this criminal case. I believe I've experienced something along these lines, if you want me to share that.
Sure. No, yep.
And it's pretty personal because it has to do with my own mother. And I've written a little bit about this, but Austin, you would know better than Kyle that my mother was mentally ill for many years on a depression that just spiraled down into paranoia. And she would hear voices and things of that nature. There was a couple of times where mom got so weak and deluded that she would quit eating. And on one occasion, my mom, she'd broken a collarbone, and she was in a, you know, facility, and she stopped eating, and they were trying to do everything to get her to eat or drink, and she just refused. And so finally they put her into a hospital, and I went to the emergency room, and as I come to the room, there's a security guard there, and he's saying, I'm not sure that you want to go in. And I says, well, that's my mom. And he says, okay. And when I walk in, My mom is just like a wild, almost animal-like in her behaviors. And the very first thing that she said to me in a growling voice that wasn't her normal voice by any means is, "What do I have to do with you, Mr. Holy, Holy, Holy?" And then went on to just start accusing me of all kinds of things. And it wasn't my mom. it was my mom doesn't even know Isaiah 6. You know, she wouldn't know to quote from that. And that she said that, just I felt more close to the pit of hell than I feel like I've ever experienced in my life. And it just made me realize going through that as we go through the hallway of the hospital and she continues to yell out accusations against me and just the shame and the embarrassment, the tears that came to my eyes as I was going through all of this. I do believe not that my mom was possessed, but that she definitely, because of her weakened state of body and mind, was being attacked. And I feel like that was demonic activity being witnessed in the life of my mom. I think that, you know, this stuff that's coming out in the news about these people on drugs that end up doing all these awful behaviors, you know, attacking people, cannibalistic behaviors, things of that nature. I mean, people are opening their hearts and minds to demonic activity. And so I do think it's real. I guess what I'm trying to get at is the practical side of this, that we do need to be aware as a church that, you know, there is a spiritual war going on and there are real beings out there that are demonic and can influence people, and that we need to really go out, as Kyle was saying earlier, in the girded in the spiritual armor that God has provided for us. And when we're being lied to, you know, fight it with truth. When we're being attacked, you know, when those accusations are coming at us, we need to exercise our shield of faith, and we need to be, you know, coming at these things with the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, and with the prayer that should be accompanying that. So.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to take us. So you anticipated my question, and that was basically like, yeah, I think it is easy to fall into curiosities about these things. I mean, it is, in one sense, frighteningly intriguing. Like an article like this definitely makes you go, "Well, what is going on here?" And I suppose a person could, you know, go back and forth on some of these theological questions. But at the end of the day, wherever we land on the particulars, there, as you say, Barry, there's definitely the Bible compels us to believe that there is another force at play in reality that we can't see, but we can see its effects, and we can even see its effects in people, and I can speak personally where there's just been times in my life, you know, that the day of evil, as it were, you know, as Ephesians 6 talks about, where you just feel like, what is going on in my own life? And it seems inexplicable, the thoughts and some of the things you struggle with. And, you know, a person doesn't want to be superstitious, but at the same token, that's exactly what the Bible says to beware of, right? And to put on the full armor of God. So, yeah, what Roman Catholics are doing in corners with holy water, I don't know what to think.
I think too, if I can just interject a closing thought, and this comes from a pastoral perspective, you know, as a child, the thought of demon possession literally petrified me.
Yeah, it's
There, like
terrifying.
into my high school years, I had to sleep with a light on sometimes because I was so, and I've dealt with people as a pastor who have that type of petrifying fear of these things, but you know, I
Did you
think
watch a movie or something that freaked you out?
no, we When I was 7 years old, I was eavesdropping on a conversation my parents were having around the dinner table. And the company that was over that night was telling a story about how the husband was convinced that his family was attacked by a demon one night, and the husband grabbed a baseball bat and chased the demon out of the house.
I was
7 years old. I was terrified. So
you would be.
Right. I do think, you know, to look at the overall general teaching of the Bible, you know, demonic activity and the work of Satan is not primarily to make things go bump at night and to spook us. It is to blind our mind's eye to keep us from seeing the light of the glory of the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, and I think when I finally came to that understanding, realizing that that is far more terrifying, to be blinded to the glory of Jesus, than what goes on when the sun goes down. You know, I guess that's one thing that I've tried to pastor people with, is just the reality is it's falsehood, it's unrighteousness, it's attacking our faith, it's you know, trying to get us to yield on scripture, and it's trying to blind us to the gospel. That's really the normative way that Satan works in the world.
Yeah, and if I could put a verse to that, it isn't holy water, it's these things. And the Lord's servant must not quarrel. Instead, he must be kind to everyone, able to teach, not resentful. Those who oppose him, he must gently instruct in the hope that God will grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth, and that they will come to their senses and escape from the trap of the devil who has taken them captive to do his will. You know, it really is this, I think, in terms of our responsibility, it's very interesting. It's just like, don't be quarrelsome, be kind, be able to teach, don't be resentful, and gently instruct. It's like, that's so everyday, you know, so in one sense mundane, but yep, gloriously mundane.
Well, I think we also have to, kind of going along with what Kyle is saying, is encourage people. You know, the scriptures also say, greater is he who is in us than the one out in the world. And if people are concerned about demonic activities or things, they need to be fleeing to the only rock and refuge against that, which is Christ, who's shown his power over it. And you know, in church history, especially think of the Puritans, they just seem to have a lot more active awareness of Satan's presence in the world. They wrote about it. You know, you've got Thomas Brooks' Precious Remedies Against Satan's Devices and other books like that, and even in just in, not even in books just devoted to this subject, you're just reading, and they make you more aware of this battle that's going on, so that we're not fighting it unawares. You know, people, like you were talking about earlier, Austin, sometimes people get discouraged, depressed, they feel this darkness over their soul, and they're often wondering what's wrong with them, and maybe not often seeing, you know, many things. It could be, you know, a particular attack of the evil one trying to discourage your soul. Satan is a roaring lion trying to devour people, and especially when we're weak. So we need to help people to be equipped to fight these battles. And again, in our modern psychiatric age, so many people, as soon as they start getting depressed, discouraged, having evil thoughts, they run and try to find a pill that will make them feel better and manage it that way. And without denying that there's some need at times for, you know, because we are an integrated body and soul, some medical kind of help, we need to make sure that that's accompanied with spiritual help. And pastors and churches, elders need to be equipped to help people in dealing with their difficulties. Not telling them not to go to the doctor, I'm not saying that, but to make sure they're not putting the doctor in his white jacket as their ultimate hope and trust, rather than really first and foremost looking to Christ and seeing the help that he gives to them in both body and soul. Because when he delivered these people in the Gospels, it was a wholesome delivery. It was a spiritual and bodily delivery. And that's what we want to see. We want to see people healthy in both body and soul as far as God will help them that way.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember what gospel it's in, but when basically Judas was leading the troop to get Christ, maybe it was John, I can't remember. It said, this is the hour of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that's just an interesting little phrase there. And you just think, had the disciples were to be praying, right? They were to be getting ready. And since they didn't, when the hour of darkness came, and in a very real sense, Satan's activity really blossoming at that moment. I mean, what happened to him? Discouraged, rejection of Christ, fleeing, right? There wasn't courage, there wasn't faith. So, you know, to me that's just, yeah, as to what you're saying, this reminder to us, we really do have to take these things seriously, because circumstances in life can be, as it were, an hour of darkness, right? That's being used to bring us down, and you have to gird your soul with the armor of God. So I'm just reiterating what we just keep saying over and over again, but I do think in Reformed circles sometimes this can get lost, and it bears repeating.
Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts, Kyle?
Nope.
He's just gonna sleep with his nightlight on tonight.
Rachel's gonna have to hold my hand all night.
Oh, man.
I'm kidding.